guess I don't have to buy one, huh? Hi, everybody. I'm Danny, and I'm a cocaine addict.
Hi, Danny.
And it's good to be here. I want to thank you for inviting me here. I think I'm going to take my jacket off. This is hot. A very good meal for a convention, I want to tell you. Is this anybody's first convention? Oh, okay. Is this your first speaker meeting at a first convention? Yeah? Okay. I want to no doubt about it that I'm going to be the best damn speaker you ever heard. All right. Well, again, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure. I appreciate it. Whenever I get the opportunity to share. This fellowship is so new. My sobriety date is November 21st, 1991. And I don't know, it's by everything I'm going to share with you tonight that's possible. So this fellowship is so new that I'm sure that there's a lot of newcomers here. And so I hope tonight that I can touch just one of you. Just to carry the message, it's just one of you. I don't know which one it is, but I hopefully just one of you will get something from what I share with you tonight. I always bring some stuff for show and tell, you know, because there was a lot of signs along the way that I had that I never paid attention to, and that, you know, showed me that I had a problem with alcohol, had a problem with drugs, and so I get this thing. Let's see. I'm going to hold it up. Hopefully everybody can see it. It says before six beers, and it's a picture of an old lady. I don't know if you can see it back there, right? But you just take the same picture and you just turn it upside down. It says after six beers, it becomes a princess. So I don't know about you guys, but if you ever went to bed with Cindy Crawford and woke up with Lassie, you understand that. There were many signs along the way that I had a problem with alcohol that I didn't pay any attention to, you know. And another sign, like if the noises in your head are grinding their teeth, that's a sign maybe you have a problem with cocaine. I don't know. So for you new people, let me just tell you what we do here in Cocaine Anonymous. And I use the analogy: there's a cocaine addict walking through the woods. And he's walking in the woods, not paying attention, and he falls in this big hole. And he's trying to climb out, and he keeps climbing up and falling back down and climbing up and falling back down, so he can't get out. He's yelling, help, help, but he keeps yelling, help, and after a little bit of time, there's a man of the cloth walking through the woods. He hears the noise, and he follows the noise. He goes over, he sees the guy in the hole, he says a prayer for him, and he keeps on walking. The guy's got a prayer, but he can't get out of the hole. He keeps climbing and falling back down. He's yelling, help, I'm... need help. About 10 minutes later, there's a doctor walking through the woods. And he hears the noise. He goes over. He sees the guy. He writes a prescription. He throws it in the hole. The guy's got a prescription. He's got a prayer, but he can't get out of the hole. About 10 minutes goes by, and there's a recovering member of Cocaine Anonymous walking through the woods, and he hears the noise. He goes over. He sees the guy down there. Immediately, he jumps in the hole. And the addict says to him, now look what you did. Now we're both in the hole. And the recovering member of Cocaine Anonymous says, yeah, but I've been here before. I know the way out of here. So, so that's what we do here. We will jump in the hole with you, but I'm going to tell you now, we're not going to carry your ass out. You've got to do the work yourself. But we will jump in the hole and put our hand out and help you all we can. And that's the miracle of Cocaine Anonymous. It's going to happen in your life if you stick around long enough for it, too. So I've been sober a long time, and, you know, we clean up pretty good, I think, all of us, and look how lovely you guys look tonight. And so I just want to tell you the analogy of cocaine for me, so you understand where I'm coming from. To me, cocaine was like the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life. And I could be in a nightclub with 3,000 people, and there she is all the way at the other end of the club, my lady cocaine, and I got to have her. And I make my way through the crowd, through all the obstacles in my life, and I get up to her, and I get lucky, and I get to leave with her. And we jump in a cab, and we're going back to my place, and all the way in the cab ride, I got this thing going on in my stomach, just anticipating how good the sex is going to be. And it's so powerful, it's choking me, right? And we get back to to her place, and we go to bed. And it was just like I knew it was going to be. It was the best lovemaking ever had. And I get up to go to the bathroom, and she reaches under the bed and grabs a bat and cracks my head. Pow! Knocks me out. Takes all my dope and all my money and all my jewelry. And about half an hour later, I come to, and I stagger to my feet, and I'm dizzy, and I'm hurting, and I'm bleeding. And the first thing I say is, where is she? I got to find her. I know she didn't mean that. I know she loves me. And then I buy the lie one more time, and I tell myself, when I find her this time, it's going to be different. Now, some of you sitting here going, is he talking about a woman, or is he talking about cocaine? It really don't make a difference, does it? So, I mean, that's the analogy of me for cocaine. So, I definitely earned my seat here. And I'm going to share with you tonight about some of the insanity of this disease. But there's four things that I always talk about. Four things that are important in my life today, not in any particular order. One thing is God. I have a good, loving relationship with the powerful God in my life today. I didn't have that when I got here. So that's one of the things that are so important. Another thing I talk about is miracles. I don't know most of you guys, but I could bet you that this room is full of miracles. I'm a miracle. I know I'm a miracle. And without knowing you, I could tell this room is full of miracles. I really believe that. Another thing I always talk about is angels. I believe in angels. I believe there's angels all around us all the time. And hopefully when I share with you tonight, I'll be talking about God and miracles and angels. And the fourth thing is the reason that I believe in the first three. I believe in Cocaine Anonymous. If it weren't for Cocaine Anonymous, I wouldn't have a God in my life. I wouldn't understand what kind of miracle I am. And I wouldn't be in touch with the angels all around me. And that's my truth. So it's very important, Cocaine Anonymous, for me. So we share about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I want to share a little bit for you what it was like for me. I was very young when I was born. My earliest memories is, see, there's always been something the matter with me. And I don't come from a home where my mom and dad were an alcoholic or drug addicts. I come from a very good, loving Italian family. My dad was a street guy, but at home he was a good man and a good father. And it was love in my house. So I grew up with a lot of love. So I can't stand here tonight and tell you, the way I was brought up is why it turned out that, no, it's not. But, you know, and I don't get into the great debate, are we born with alcoholism or we develop it? Don't matter. Either way, you have to drink or use to make it mean anything. So that's the thing. So for me, my earliest memories, see, there's something wrong with my thinking as far back as I can remember. I'm born and raised in the Bronx in New York, which is makes me a huge Yankee fan, which don't mean nothing to you guys here. But they don't like that much when I share in Boston and places like that. But the New York Yankees was my thing. When I was a little kid, maybe 5 years old or something, I had all the baseball cards of the Yankees. In America, that was a big thing. You collect the baseball cards, you know, and you flip and you take the other guy's cards and you win or lose cards. And I had everybody on the Yankee team except for Roger Maris, who was an outfielder for the Yankees. And there was another little kid in my neighborhood. I'm like 5 or 6 years old. Another little kid in my neighborhood had all the Yankees except for Yogi Berra. And he says to me, you want to flip Roger Maris for Yogi Berra? And I said, sure. And we made an appointment to meet in the park the next day. And I went home and I practiced flipping all day. And all I, you know, flipping this card to get it perfect, because all I thought about was tomorrow I'm going to have the entire Yankee team. And that was the world to me as a little six-year-old kid at that time. And so I met the kid the next day in the park and we flipped and he won. And all of a sudden something happened to me. So I got this choking in me that I realized not only am I not going to get Roger Maris, I'm about to lose Yogi Berra. And I couldn't breathe. I couldn't let that happen. I kicked his ass and took all his baseball cards. True story. And I learned a valuable lesson that day. Little six-year-old kid. I learned that if you can't get what you want in life the right way, just kick some ass and take it. And I proceeded to spend the next 30 years of my life that way. And another thing, maybe about a year later, about 7 years old, in my neighborhood, we used to have the feast. I don't know if you ever seen it on TV or the movies or something. It's a little tiny festival, and they block the streets off, and they bring games and food carts into the streets. And for 10 days, we have a big festival in the streets. And I had a quarter. Back in those days, for a quarter, you could buy a lot of stuff. And I went down to the feast. My building was right there on the block where the feast was, and I went down to the feast. You ever see the movie Godfather Part 2? That's the feast. That's what I'm talking about, where he's following the guy in the white hat, Fanucci, whatever his name is. Anyway, so I go down to the feast, and I got a quarter. I get to go to the cotton candy stand, and I buy a thing of cotton candy, and I ate it up. It was good. I liked it. I wanted more, and I was able to buy another one with the same quarter. So I got another thing of cotton candy. It was good. I liked it. I ate it all up. I wanted more. And I didn't have any money left, so I went upstairs to the apartment. And one of my brothers had these little gray safes with the red dials, old safes that they used to have. So here I am, like 6 or 7 years old, and I got a butter knife, and I'm cracking my brother's safe open with the butter knife. And I get it open, I take a half a buck, and I go back down to the feast, and I ate up a half a dollar's worth of cotton candy. It was good, I liked it, I wanted more, and I ran out of money. So I went back up to the apartment, I went to my mother's purse, and I took a dollar. And I went back down to the feast. And again, I'm like 7 years old. And now I'm getting paranoid. Because, wait a minute, phone call, hold on. So I'm getting paranoid now. I'm thinking, somebody's going to say to me, where are you getting all this money for this cotton candy, right? I'm 7 years old. Like, anybody's paying attention to me. There's thousands of people in the streets. So I get some cotton candy, and I go in the alleyway between two buildings, and I'm crouching down. I'm eating the cotton candy, right? And 25 years later, I'm in the same neighborhood, crouching in the same alleyways, hitting the pipe before I went up to the apartment to see somebody. And I had a flashback of that little kid. The same tendencies, you know? Just doing what you want, and doesn't matter. It was my brother's money, my mother's money. I wanted more, and that's all that mattered to me. And so again, these lessons I learned early in life, and that's how I live my life. Just do what you want to whoever you want, however you want to do it, and F them if they don't like it. And that was my attitude. And I live like that. And it's not a great way to live. But so my family, I tell you, my family was good. So my dad used to pick me up and hug me. He used to say, I love you, Danny. And for this little kid growing up in that home, I just couldn't wait to wake up in the mornings and get out and hit the world because life was good. You know, I truly felt at peace with myself and one with the world. I didn't hear those words till I came into recovery, but looking back on it, I truly felt like that. And my dad would pick me up and he'd hug me and he'd say, I love you, Dan. My mom would pick me up and she'd hug me and she'd say, I love you, Danny. I said, I love you too, Mom. You know, life was good for me. My grandmother was from Italy. She didn't speak a lot of English. She used to hug me and say, Benissan. And I'd say, Benissan. And life was good. And one night I was 10 years old, and I had three brothers. We all slept in the same room. And it was late at night one night, and I couldn't sleep for some reason. And I was up, and somebody knocked on the door of the apartment. And I went out into the hallway, and I'm listening. My mother answered the door, and there was a policeman there. And he said that there was a shootout, and my dad was dead. And I had never experienced death like that at 10 years old. And in no time, my apartment was full of people. And the men were in one corner whispering, and the women were in another corner crying. And I walked into the living room, and I went up to one of my uncles, and I said, what's going on? And he said, your daddy's dead. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, that means he's not coming back no more, Dan. And I didn't understand that then, at that moment. And I was 33 years old when I got sober. And it was about a year into sobriety before I really understood what that meant, what he said to me. Because I had spent the rest of my life after that blocking myself off from people. I didn't know it. I had no idea. But I sponsor and work with a lot of people and do a lot of workshops. And I've met thousands of people over the years that have the same problem. We don't know how to accept love. So I was always a good Santa Claus and a good for your birthday. I was there. But I don't know how to accept love. Because after that, my mother would hug me. She'd say, I love you, Dan. I said, I love you too, Ma. And my grandmother would hug me. She'd say, Benissan, Dan. I said, Benissan, Mom. And I'm a fortunate man. I've had women in my life that truly love me and want to be part of my life. They say, I love you, Dan. I say, I love you too. I got to give it right back to you because I don't know how to accept it. You know? And I learned in recovery how to understand that and how to accept and how to deal with people, allowing people to love me. And that's something that a lot of us lack. And if you stick around and work the steps, you could work through that stuff and your life will change. You see, because that's a problem we all have to greater and lesser degrees. So you know, in a nutshell, that's my childhood. You know, I started drinking 12 years old. Matter of fact, by the time I was 13, I had 6 months in reform school. By the time I was 14, I had 18 months in reform school. By the time I was 16 years old, I was locked up for 2 years. As an adult, 6.5 years in prison behind the wall. And I realized that, you know, I just shut myself off from everybody. Because, you know, when people would tell me, I love you, Daddy, I love you too. On the outside. My grandma would say, Benesan, say Benesan, Noni. On the outside. But on the inside, I was shut down. And I built walls around me. And when I came into recovery and you people talked about a higher power and God, I didn't want no part of that. I didn't get sober to find God. My father was God to me, and he was dead, and I spent the rest of my life trying to take his place and be God. I was not interested in talking to you or anybody else about God. It wasn't on the agenda. I just had this 2,000-pound gorilla on my back, and I was trying to get rid of him. And you know, if you got a 2,000-pound gorilla on your back, you know what he does? Any damn thing he pleases. You're just the vehicle he uses. And that's all I wanted was to get this gorilla off my back. That's all I wanted. I didn't want to talk about God or anything like that. I didn't know that we had to deal with the feel. We had to dealing with feelings is what recovery is really about. I didn't know that. I just wanted this gorilla off my back when I crawled into these rooms. So if anybody's having those problems where you don't know how to accept love and handle love, stick around. Work the steps. Get with somebody that's got some sobriety and he'll help you with that. It works. It really does. Your life can change. I could look you in the eye today and I could tell you, I know how to accept love. If somebody says to me, that's a nice shirt, I say, thank you. Used to be, that's a nice shirt. Yeah, yours too. Because I don't know how to handle it. I got to give it right back to you. Thanks, Dan. No, thank you. When I got sober, I was sitting in a meeting. It was actually an AA meeting. I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day, and I got this thought. I'm about maybe 6-8 months sober, and I got this thought. I don't really remember. Maybe I was a year sober, but it was early in my sobriety. And I got this thought, and it was such a powerful thought, and it helped free me. And I was sitting in the meeting because my first year sober, I wanted to get high every day. I'd sit in meetings, and I'd think about getting some nice rocks or something, and the meeting be people be everybody was smiling and nodding their head, and I saw I going there, and they say, how you doing, Dan? I say, good. And I'm dying inside, and I don't want you to know that I'm dying inside, you know. I'm going to tell you something. If you knew and you don't know this yet, we know that if you come in here, you're dying inside. Nobody gets up in the morning and goes, my life is great, I think I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I'll join Cocaine Anonymous. That doesn't happen. If you're anything like me, this was the last house on the block. I tried everything humanly possible not to get here. That's why I know that there's a God, because this is where I wound up and this is how I got free. And I'm sitting in this meeting and I got this thought. And it was such a simple thought. And it was the thought that I got was this. Because I was sitting there, people were sharing, and I'm thinking about getting some dope. And then I had this thought. I said, you know what, Danny? You're better off sitting in a meeting wanting to get high than you are sitting in the dope house wanting to be sober. That's a hell of a thought. That's a powerful, releasing thought. So My life was a mess. I got married very young. I shared with you guys today. My kids are 40, 41 years old. I got a 23-year-old granddaughter. I got four grand... Tell me God ain't got a sense of humor. I got three daughters and four granddaughters. All right? God's got a sense of humor, believe me. Seven girls. And they love me, all of them love me unconditionally in spite of myself. My children and my grandchildren have never seen me loaded, but my kids, you know, 26 and a half years sober, they're 40, 41, they've seen me loaded. They used to come visit me in prison when they were little kids, so they know. But they all love me unconditionally in spite of me. And I want to tell you this. That's not because of Cocaine Anonymous. I always had a great relationship with my kids, even when I was lost and alone and frightened. My kids never stopped loving me. Go figure. I'm a blessed man. I am truly a blessed man because I understand today in my life, I understand that's what it's all about, people. That's what it's really all about. Nothing else matters. Nothing else really means anything. Your family. And your extended family. I got friends, in the, you know, Ian, Matthias, and I know these people for years now. I go anywhere in the world and I got friends that I know for years. And when they come to Florida, everybody comes to Florida. It's paradise. They come to Florida, they're all welcome in my home. All right. So what happened was... What happened for me was my life was insane from day one, right? And I'm living on the streets. I didn't have a job until I was 2 years sober. Never had a job until I was 35 years old. First time I've had a job in my life. A real job, I mean. I made good money, but I didn't have a job. So for me, you know, I wound up getting a prison sentence. My wife stuck with me through all of that stuff. And the insanity never stopped, you know. There was a point in my life where she came up to me and she said, "You're killing yourself and everybody around you, and I can't take no more. I'm out of here." And I said, "You leaving me?" like I was a prize, right? We were childhood sweethearts. We grew up together. And, you know, and she was gone. And my sick mind said, "Wow, I'm free now. I could really let loose." You know, like I wasn't letting loose already, you know. See, the insanity of this disease is I can't stop doing it. The insanity of this disease is that I swear I'm not going to do it again, but there I am doing it again. And at the end, for me, I'd be out for 2 or 3 days, and it'd be 1 o'clock in the morning, or it'd be 11 o'clock at night. I don't want to go home because people are still up. So I wait till 1, 2 in the morning, and then I come in the house, and I'm tiptoeing, right? And I'm being real quiet. I don't want to take my clothes off because I don't want to wake her up. So I just kick my shoes off and I real gently get into bed. And I take a deep breath because I don't want to breathe. I don't want to wake her up, right? And I lay there trying to go to sleep. And I think to some insane stuff. Like in the morning when I wake up, she's going to say, "Honey, you're home. I've missed you." And all that money that I spent is going to be under my pillow. And the kids are going to jump on my lap and say, "Daddy, Daddy, we love you." And I'd lay there for hours until I'd pass out. And the next day I'd come to, and I'd look under my pillow, and there'd be no money there. And I'd hear my wife in the kitchen, and I'd get up, and I'd go in the kitchen, and she'd look at me, and she'd say, "You son of a bitch, you did it again." And I'd been out for 3 days, and I needed a shave, and I smelled, and my eyes were sunken in, my cheeks were sunken in, and I looked bad. And the kids would hear my voice, they'd run into the kitchen, and they'd look at me, and they'd run back in their room. Because I look like death warmed over, the Reaper Man. And I go to the bathroom and I look at myself in the mirror and I say, "What's the matter with you, Danny? Why can't you stop this? You're weak." And I look at myself and I say, "I swear to God, I'm not going to do this no more." And mean it with every fiber of my being. I'd swear to myself, this was it. I ain't going to do it no more. And I'd brush my teeth and shower and shave and get some tea and get dressed, and I tell my wife, "I got to go get some money." She say, "Don't go out. Stay home." And I say, no, I blew a lot of money. I got to go get some money. She say, "Please, stay home." And I say, "No, I'll be back soon."
And 3 days later, I'd be tiptoeing back into the house, holding my breath, laying down again. The vicious cycle is. The insanity of this disease is I can't stop doing it. There's no great thoughts or process. I can't stop doing it. That's the insanity of this disease. I don't want to do it. I swear I ain't going to do it no more. And I can't stop doing it. I'm stuck in this vicious cycle. And it was no good. And she left me. And when she left me, now I get a little apartment down in Manhattan. And I'm getting high 24/7. And it was just insane. Just insane. And I remember I'd get some dope with a friend of mine, and we'd go up to my apartment, and he'd hit the pipe. And as soon as he hit the pipe, he'd go, "There's somebody at the window." And I'd say to him, "We're on the 9th floor." And he'd pass me the pipe, and I'd hit the pipe. I'd go, "You're right, there's somebody out there." I can't understand how I'd pay thousands of dollars to get that way today. It doesn't make any sense looking back on it. It's like paying for somebody to torture you, right? It's just insane. And I remember one day I said to myself, "You're doing too much coke, Dan. You got to slow down. You got to stop." And there was this lady that I was talking to. She was a normie. She didn't drink or do drugs. And so I called her up. I said, "Would you like to go for dinner?" She said, "Sure." So I said, "All right, I'll come by and get you." And I got all dressed up. I put a suit and tie on. It was raining really hard this night. I put a suit and tie on. I jump in a cab. We go to her place. I pick her up. We're sitting in this restaurant. Nice place, and we're eating, and we're eating, and the cocaine that I got at home is calling me. And it's, we're eating the cocaine. "Danny! Danny!" And I'm going like, I'm trying to be normal, right? I'm trying to prove to myself that I'm normal. I'm okay. And we're talking, "Danny!" So we rush through the meal. We jump back in the cab, and we go to my place. And I say, "Sit down, honey. I'll be with you in a minute." And I get my stash, and I go in the bedroom, and I got my suit and tie on, and I step in the shower. And I hit that bad boy. Now, can you imagine this woman sitting on my couch waiting for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to come out of the bedroom? And I come out of the bedroom after about 30 minutes, sweating like a bastard. So I got my tie, I'm in the shower, I'm sweating, my eyes are like this. I'm holding my pants because they're making too much noise. I kind of tiptoed, combat crawled right by her like she wasn't even there. I go to the window and I peek out the window. And just as I peeked out the window, the lightning struck. And I said, "Oh shit, they just took my picture." She got up and ran out of that apartment. And I lived in New York, so I had like 4 locks, right? I shut the door and I bolted it up behind her and I went, "Thank God she's gone. She was fucking my high up." That's the insanity of this disease. You know the one? I got sober, and all of these years, I've been trying to find this lady. I don't even remember her name. Because I just want to apologize so bad to her. She probably never dated an Italian guy again after that. Oh, no, these friggin' Italians are nuts. The insanity of this disease is I can't stop doing it. I don't want to do it. I swear I ain't going to do it no more. But I can't stop doing it. And I had some friends of mine from the neighborhood that were down in Florida. And they kept saying, "Come on down to Florida. We're making money down here." So I said, "All right." So I was going back and forth, New York, Florida, New York, Florida. And I had my eye on this restaurant in Florida. And I come from Little Italy in the Bronx, and so what that means is that people actually move from Italy and they come to my neighborhood or another similar neighborhood. And so I had this guy that just moved from Italy to my neighborhood. His name was Luigi. He had a wife and 2 kids. And
So I had my eye on this restaurant in Florida, and I went back up to the neighborhood. I said, Luigi, come down to Florida. We'll put this restaurant in your name. I said, all I want is I'm going to come every week, get an envelope for you. The rest is yours. And he said, Danny, all I want is for my kids to grow up in America. And I had a part to play in those days. I used to play it well. I said, Luigi, you stay with me. Not only will your kids grow up in America, you'll be rich. And I moved this man and his family down to Florida, bought this restaurant, put his name. I got myself a little condo. And all I was doing was hitting the pipe 24/7. Passing out, coming to, and hitting the pipe. And I'd go once a week to the restaurant and get money from him. And that was it. And one day I met this guy at the restaurant and I got a kilo of cocaine. And I broke off a big rock and I went to the ceiling. I pushed the ceiling up. I put the rest in the ceiling and I went home. And when I talk about angels, what I'm talking about is that I know the angels were around me all my life protecting me. Because when I got back to my condo, I did something that I never did before. I knew I was going to get high for 3 days and I wanted to eat something first, you know. So I took this bag and I put my scale and the dope and all this paraphernalia in it. And then I took my pistol and I put my pistol in there. And I've never done that in my life because I was schooled. You never give anybody. The worst insult in the world is get shot with your own pistol, right? So you don't give nobody your pistol. But I put the pistol in there and I zipped it up. I went to the guy living underneath me. I knocked on his door. I said, do me a favor. Hold this for me. And I'll take care of you. I'm going to eat some. He said, sure, Dan. Don't worry about it. So I went back upstairs and I'm making myself a meal and the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, federal agency, came and busted my door down and took me down to Miami. And I'm sitting at a desk and the agent says to me, we found a kilo of cocaine in your restaurant. And me, being the stand-up guy I was, I said, I don't own a restaurant. And he said, we know that's your restaurant. I said, listen, if you found something in a restaurant, you need to talk to somebody else because I don't own a restaurant. I don't know what you're talking about. And they had Luigi in the next room. And Luigi had a green card. He wasn't a citizen. They weren't letting him go. And they were charging him with the kilo of cocaine. Unless I copped to it. And I wasn't copping to shit. And after a while, some hours later, my lawyer came and got me out. And I went back to my apartment. And the guy downstairs helped me board the door up. And I'm sitting in there. And I felt like the worst piece of crap I've ever felt in my life. Here was this man, his wife was calling me on the phone, I'm not answering the phone, and I just wanted not to feel. I just needed to escape. And I'm smoking, I'm thinking, you know, any minute he's gonna give me up. And I'm there for 3 days. And I got the pistol in one hand, the pipe in the other hand, I don't know which one to suck on next. Because I know they're coming back for me. And what I'm doing is I put the pistol down, I crawl out to the terrace and I look on the terrace because I heard it was the night of the third day, nighttime was coming and the crickets, every night the crickets would come out and they'd make their little crickety sound. And I heard that. I was living down there for about a year at the time. And except for that night, I didn't hear it to be the crickets. What I heard that noise to be was the crackling of the police radios and I knew I was surrounded. So I'm looking for where they're hiding. And I crawl back in, I put the pipe down, I pick the pistol up, I put the pistol down, and I crawl back up, out, and I look again, and I'm crawling back in and out for hours. And then I heard these words. I heard somebody say, okay, Sarge, let's go. And that was it. The big book talks about we made many decisions, but never many resolutions, but never a decision. I made a decision right there. And my decision was, I ain't going to jail. I'm too messed up. I'm going to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Somebody's dying with me, but they ain't taking me in. And for the first time in hours, I got to my feet. And what happened this quick, in seconds. I grabbed the pistol, and I went to the terrace, and I looked, reached down, and I looked down, and I saw one guy down there. He never even saw me. I looked down. He was right underneath me. And I hesitated for just a second. I went, one guy? For me? Don't they know who I think I am? And just in that hesitation, he did it again. He said, come on, Sarge, let's go. And his dog came. The guy was walking his dog. And he never looked up. He never saw the bug-eyed crazy man on top of him. He don't know to this day that he came this close to dying. I was about to shoot him. And my whole body was shaking. I went back into the apartment. I picked that 200-pound phone up. And I called New York and I called my brother. I said, I'm dying down here. I need some help. Now, I can't stress to you what kind of miracle that was. Because up to that point in my life, I spent my entire life being a tough guy. I made a living hurting people. And for me to pick up a phone and call somebody and say, I need help, was beyond me. I know, as sure as I'm standing here now, that my God was up there going, all right, so this guy's had enough. Send the angels down and do something for him. And that's what happened. And my brother said, give me a little while. And he called me back and he said, I got you in treatment center. I'm taking the red eye down there. We'll go back up tomorrow. You're going into the hospital. And I said, okay. I hung up the phone with him. And I hear people come to the podium all the time. And they say, I dropped my dope down the drain. I flushed it. I threw my dope out. That's not my story. I got about 100 grams left of dope. And I'm trying to smoke it up before my brother gets there, right? And I'm coming into the fort. I'm smoking rocks so big it's melting down the side. And my brother comes the next early in the morning. And we go to the airport. And this is 1991, so it was different then. You can't do it today, but... So I got the dope on me, and we're 30,000 feet up halfway to New York, and I go in the bathroom, and I take the pipe out, and I hit the pipe. And now I can't come out of the bathroom. I think as soon as I open the bathroom door on the plane, everybody's going to go. They're waiting for me to come out. And I was in there so long, the stewardess, you okay, sir? And I said, no, I'm sick, I'm telling you. And we land at LaGuardia Airport. We get in the cab and we go in my brother's car and we drive down to Manhattan. He pulls in front of the hospital and he says, come on, this is it. I said, I can't go in now. I'm too fucked up. My fourth day. Go around the block. And we go around the block a couple of times. He pulls in front of the hospital. He says, you got to go in. And I can't tell you how I got out of that car and went to the hospital except to tell you that the angels came and touched me. I believe that today. Because I got out of that car and I walked into that hospital. Wired up as can be. And that was my sobriety day. And I want to tell you, I went into the hospital and I crashed. And about, I think my third day, I got up. And it was the first time I didn't have to go to the bathroom. And I ate something. And I went to my first meeting ever in my life. And it was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And two old ladies were there. And this one lady shared, if I live to be another 100 years, I'll never forget what she said. She said, I'm positive. There's no doubt in my mind. The three most important things that I do each day when I wake up is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. And I went, I'm out of here. I'm dying. What is she talking about putting the cap on the toothpaste? This place is insane. And I can't tell you how I didn't leave that place except to tell you the angels stopped me. Because I stayed. And I didn't learn shit in treatment. And I didn't learn nothing in treatment. I take that back. I learned two three-letter words. Why and try. The counselors would say, Danny, do this. I why? And I'd say, Danny, can you do this? And I go, I'll try. Come on, Danny. Okay, I'll try. Which is total bullshit, man. Because, you know... I don't know about you guys, but I never tried to get high. Nobody ever said to me, would you like a drink? Why? Nobody said, you want to do a hit? Damn, I'll try. I made it happen. My first step is what I call the Houdini step for me. What I mean by that is, you could have put me in a straitjacket and padlocked it. And wrap some chains around me and padlock it. Fold me over and put me in a box. Wrap some chains around the box. Padlock it. Kick it off into the water. And watch me get to the dope house before I hit bottom. Before that chest hits bottom, I'm at the dope house getting high. Yet I come into recovery. They say, read this chapter. And I go, I'll try. What kind of bullshit is that? Are you laughing because you said that shit too? I'll try. And a guy said to me, don't try, Danny. Do it. Yeah. Make it happen. Make believe you're chasing that dope. Oh, I can make it happen if I'm chasing the dope. And that's really what it is. A guy that I was in prison with brought a meeting to the hospital there. And that, actually, he was my Ebby Thatcher. He became my sponsor and took me through this process, and I'm not going to walk you through the steps. It's not my job. I do want to share with you a couple of things. My sponsor said to me,
We sat down, we talked a little about recovery. He says to me, "You're going to go far, Danny." And I said, "Thank you." He says, "It's because you got so far to go." I always thought he was complimenting me, and he wasn't. One day he says to me, "You're very smart." I said, "Thank you." He said, "It wasn't a compliment." I had just spent the last 5 years peeping out the window and crawling on the floors. I mean, longer than that, but constantly in the last 5 years. These are not wrinkles on my face, people. These are Venetian blind marks from peeping out the window for so many years. But, so my first step, right, that's what I got to do. I got to understand what the problem is and do this, right? And early in my recovery, you people, the second step, we talked about God. And I didn't come here. I told you that. I didn't come here to find God. And I had a real negative attitude about that. And a guy pulled me aside and he says to me, at the time I had two daughters. He said to me, "Danny," he says, "you got two daughters?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Let me ask you a question." He said, "If your oldest daughter became a junkie and was hitting old ladies upside the head, taking their money, would you hate her?" I said, "No, I wouldn't hate her." "If your other daughter became a prostitute and was selling her butt, would you hate her?" I said, "No, of course not." He said, "Do you believe there's a God?" I said, "I'm also a recovering Roman Catholic." So I said, "Sure, I know there's a God." He said, "Well, let me see if I got this right. You think that you have the capacity to love your children unconditionally, but God can't love you that way in spite of yourself?" And you know what? That moment on, my life had changed. From that man saying that to me, then you never know what you're going to hear from somebody in these rooms. When that man said that to me, my life had changed because I understood instantly that God loves me just as I am. I could be robbing a bank. My God loves me just as much as I am working one-on-one with another addict. I really believe that today. And if that's the truth, that my God loves me regardless of how I am, then the only thing that matters is how do I love God back? That's the only thing that counts. And how I love God back depends on what I do today. You know, how I'm living. And so, I want to share some more things with you. You know, in the third step, there was this saying going around the rooms. People were talking about, let go and let God. Give it to God. Give it to God. And I had this huge problem. Big problem. I don't remember what it was, but I know it was at the time it was huge. And I went to my sponsor and I shared this huge problem with him. And he said, "What are you going to do about that?" I said, "Give it to God." Because that's what I heard people sharing about in the rooms. Give it to God. So about a week or two goes by, and I still got this problem. It's even worse. And I go to my sponsor. I said, "What's up with this? I gave this to God 2 weeks ago." He said, "Danny, God don't want that shit either." He said, "There's nothing in step three that relieves me of the responsibility of taking action." I thought, "I give it to God. I ain't got to do shit." No. I do the work. I leave the results to the care of God. That's what we're talking about. I do the work. The results of that work is none of my business. That's where God comes in. That's what I give to God. People, if you can get out of the result business, your spirituality will grow way beyond your wildest dreams. Just from getting out of the result business. You could plan, just don't plan the results. Just do the next right thing, and whatever happens is the way it is. If you check your motives and do the next right thing, it's none of your business, the results of that. And that's what happens. I'm 18 months sober. An army buddy of mine calls me up from Oklahoma City and says, "Can you come out and do this real estate deal with me?" I said, "Sure." I had nothing going on really, you know. So I go out there. I'm supposed to be out there 2 weeks. 17 years later, I come back from Oklahoma City. But I look back and I see God's hand all in that, because they started a fellowship there, Cocaine Anonymous, where there wasn't one. And last week they celebrated their 25th anniversary, Cocaine Anonymous out there. So, you know, I see God working, and I saw him working for years out there. But what happened was, when I had 2 years sober, I wanted to fly back to New York and celebrate with my home group in New York. And I got to share this with you, because anytime I get the chance to share this with you.
So I go to a meeting. We have cakes in New York, sing happy birthday. I get my medallion, put it in my pocket. The next day, I'm with my kids in Manhattan, and they're shopping. They're running in and out of stores. And I'm standing on the sidewalk. I'm about four stores up the block from the corner. And all of a sudden, I'm washed with this desire to get loaded. I count my money, and I think, when the kids come out of the store, I'm going to tell them I don't feel good. I'm taking them home, and I'm going to go get me some dope. 2 years sober, the medallion in my pocket from the night before. And then I remembered in the book, that it says somewhere in the book, that we're all going to be hit with a desire that nobody can do anything about, but God can. So I looked up to God, and I said, God, please help me. Because I really don't want to get high as much as I want to get high. And I looked to the corner, and there was a guy in New York on the streets, people sell stuff, and this guy had this kind of a thing set up, and he had these wooden plaques on this thing, and they were all pictures of animals, shellacked. But one in the middle was writing, and I was too far up the street, and I walked up to it. It caught my eye. I was kind of hypnotized. I walked up to it. I'm going to read it for you because it saved my life. And when I got up close to it, in big print, it said the letter. Dear friend, how are you? I just had to send a note to tell you how much I care about you. I saw you yesterday as you were talking with your friends. I waited all day hoping you would want to talk with me too. I gave you a sunset to close your day and a cool breeze to rest you. And I waited. You never came. It hurt me. But I still love you because I am your friend. I saw you sleeping last night and longed to touch your brow, so I spilled moonlight upon your face. Again I waited, wanting to rush down so we could talk. I have so many gifts for you. You awoke and rushed off to work. My tears were in the rain. If you would only listen to me. I love you. I try to tell you in blue skies and the quiet green grass. I whisper it on leaves on trees and breathe it in colors of flowers. Shout it to you in mountain streams and give the birds love songs to sing. I clothe you with warm sunshine and perfume the air with nature scents. My love for you is deeper than the ocean and bigger than the biggest need in your heart. Ask me. Talk with me. Please don't forget me. I have so much to share with you. I won't hassle you any further. It is your decision. I have chosen you, and I will wait. I love you, your friend, Jesus. And those for you guys that have been to my house, anybody comes to my house, it hangs right next to my front door. That was almost 25 years ago. It's still hanging next to my front door. I'll never let go of that thing because it saved my life. Because God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And when the kids came out of the store, they said, what's that, Dad? I said, oh, just a little something I needed today. Amen is right, brother. And we went about our merry way, and the next day I went back to Oklahoma City. And 1 month later, that was November's my birthday, 1 month later, December, I got indicted by the federal government, Southern District of New York, for records of my past. And I had to fly back to New York and surrender myself to the feds. And I had to get a probation report done. The probation officer was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he recommended 7 years incarceration. My minimum was a 10-year on the charge. But because I'm had such a bad record, the judge, as I told my lawyer, I said, just make a deal for me. Just plead guilty. He said, Danny, with your record, the judge could go outside the guidelines and give you life. I said, I'll call you back tomorrow. The next day, I called him back. I said, make a deal. But just plead guilty. And that's when I went and got my pre-sentence report done from the probation officer. He recommended 7 years. And we didn't have the internet really in those days. So people were faxing letters to the judge, calling the judge up, sending letters in the mail to the judge. Then the judge died. And I got a brand new federal prosecutor. And my lawyer's calling me up in a panic. He says, oh my God, this is no good. You're going to be his first case. We got to postpone. Because I was supposed to get sentenced in January coming up. And I said, no, we're not postponing.
He said, Danny, this guy's the first case. We can't have this. I said, just... And I was talking to people, and a guy in a CA meeting says to me, don't worry about nothing, Danny. Well, everything you do for helping people, God's going to get your back. He says, God's going to take care of you. You're not going nowhere. And then in an AA meeting, a drunk says to me, maybe God wants you to carry the message in prison. I leave it to these drunks to screw shit up, right? And I'm going like this. Listen, I know how to do time. I just don't know how to do time sober, you know. I know how to do time, but I don't know if I want to be sober doing time, you know. And so I went in front of the judge, and he said, stand up. You got anything to say for yourself? And I said, yeah, Your Honor. I said, that paper you have in front of you is me. I did that. But the person in front of you is somebody different today. And he held up a stack of papers about this big. He said, I got all these papers on you. I read every one of them. They're very impressive. He says, but 7 years is a joke. You're not getting anything like 7 years in this courtroom. So he was about to whack me with some heavy time. And then as he was putting his gavel down, the angels came and touched him. And I saw it. I didn't see the angels, but I saw this man because he went like this. He went, and I don't know why I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But and he gave me a 5-year suspended sentence and a fine, a large fine. Huge fine. It broke me with the fine. Big fine. But a suspended sentence. And I went, yeah! And I hugged my lawyer. My lawyer was, holy shit. And the judge was like, what the heck did I just do? Yeah. Lock that guy up until he pays this X amount of dollars. And when they had me in the jail cell, I'm waiting to get released. I know I'm getting released. I'm just waiting for money to be deposited, so I'm getting out that day because I had everything waiting. And I knew that I had changed because here I am in the cell and I didn't feel good. I felt like I don't belong there. I was different. Cocaine Anonymous, you guys made me different. I had always been okay in a cell. Just give me a cigarette and stop my reading and leave me the hell alone. But I wasn't okay. I felt very uncomfortable. I felt like I didn't belong there. Now, don't get me screwed up here. I'm not telling anybody here that if you got to go in front of the judge and you're in CA, that you ain't got... Maybe God wants you to carry the message in prison. I don't know. I can only tell you he didn't want me to. Don't say that damn Danny said was getting... I ain't telling you that, okay? But real quick, man, I know we're running out of time, but I just want to tell you, stay focused. Stay with somebody. Stay with the heroes and not the zeros in this program. Stay with the people that work the steps and understand the big book. Because we can get distracted so easily. I got to tell you a quick story about this guy. He's a workaholic, right? And he's working all the time, and he pulls into his driveway, and he gets out of his car with his attaché case, and his little boy comes running up to him. He says, Dad, can we play? And he said, not now, son, I'm busy. And the kid is all the way toward the house. The kid's pulling on his pants. Come on, Dad, you said yesterday we could play today. And the guy says, I got so much to do. He walks in the hallway. There's a little table there. There's a magazine open. And there's a picture of the map of the world. And he takes the page and he rips it out. He rips it in 100 little pieces. He gives it to the kid. He says, go upstairs and put this together and we'll play. 5 minutes later, the kid comes down. And he's got this whole thing put together perfectly. All taped together. And the guy finally gets the guy's attention. And the guy says, wow, how'd you do that? How'd you put that together so quick? He gets, it was easy, Dad. On the other side of the picture of the map was a picture of a man. I put the man together and the whole world fell into place. That's what we do here, people. We take the broken man and the broken woman and we put them back together again. If anybody's sitting here tonight feeling like Humpty Dumpty, I want to tell you that all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put your sick ass back together again. But we can. We have a way out. We take broken men and broken women and we make them whole again. We make mothers and brothers and fathers and sons and friends and workers. We do that. We do that every day. That's the miracle of Cocaine Anonymous. And real quick, because I know I'm running out of time, but real quick, I want to share with you what's happened to me in the last 10 years ago. They diagnosed me with cancer, gave me 6 months to live.
And the doctor's filling out the form. She got her back to me. She's asking me these questions. She said, "You smoke?" I said, "Yeah." "How much you smoke?" "Two packs a day." "Two packs a day?" She turned around. She said, "You got to quit." I said, "Why? You just gave me 6 months to live. I got to quit." "6 months to live." I had to go every 3 months and get a colonoscopy done. I had colon cancer. Colonoscopy done, 12 tubes of blood, and all this bone marrow testing every 3 months. My third visit, so 9 months into it, the doctor was a friend of mine. I woke up in the recovery room. The doctor says to me, "Did you have chemo?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Because your cancer's gone." I said, "I don't have chemo. I have God. I want to tell you something. When they give me 6 months to live, I didn't have a problem with that." I went, "Oh no, I'm going to die." Every day's gravy for me, people. I'm supposed to be dead a long time ago. If not dead, I'm supposed to be locked in a cell, never to see the light of day again. It's all gravy for me. What I get to do with you people and get to do every day is gravy. I didn't have a problem about none of that stuff. I was okay with my life. I was okay with the people in my life. And I was okay with God. And if I got to go, I got to go. And it's 11 years later and I'm still here. Okay? So who knows about that stuff? Only God does. Don't let none of that stuff take you down or take you off mark. You know? Been a lot of things that's happened to me. I never could get out of my own way. But with you people in this program, sky's the limit. Sky's the limit. And I know I've been talking a long time, so I'm going to tell you, before I shut up, I do want to tell you that the three most important things in my life, I'm positive of today. There's no doubt in my mind. The three most important things that I do each day when I wake up is to make my bed, put the cap on the toothpaste, and hit my knees. Thank you for letting me share.